Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by audible.co.uk. Download one title each month, plus unlimited listening to thousands of Audible originals, podcasts, and audiobooks. Just click on the Audible banner at www.tre.radio.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. As always, we start by looking at the bestseller lists on Amazon.co.uk and the Sunday Times, the oldest and most influential book sales chart in the UK. Not many new entries this week. Then we'll be chatting to Margaret Gardner, who became an international cover girl at 16, Miss Universe at 18, and ultimately the fashion editor at GoldenGlobes.com. She's worked with A-list stars from Angelina Jolie to Zendaya. She knows what it's like to be on the red carpet, in the spotlight, and what goes on behind the scenes. With a degree in psychology and a focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion, her debut novel, Joey Superstar, is for every woman who has ever been made to feel less. The world of Joey Superstar is a whirlwind of cocaine, sex, and money. It's the first in an exciting new series called Damaged Beauty. Then we chat to Katharina Volkmer, who was born in Germany. She now lives in London and works for a literary agency. Her first novel, The Appointment, has been adapted for the stage and radio in several countries. Her latest novel, Calls May Be Recorded for Training and Monitoring Purposes, will make you laugh, weep, and never look the same way at an electric carving knife again. We chat to Jodie Cooksley, who studied literature and has a master's in Victorian poetry. Her new novel, The Surgeon's House, brings her fascination with the dark Victorian period to life again. And that's just the first hour. In the second hour, we're chatting to Caroline Madden, Shirley Rusak-Wachtel, Polly Clark, and Hazel Hitchens.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
I am unwritten, can't read my mind, I'm undefined. I'm just beginning, the pen's in my hand. Before you open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you, only you can let it in. No one else, no one else can speak the words on your lips. Drench yourself in words unspoken. Live your
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. As always, we take a look at the Sunday Times bestseller list first, if I can say it, the oldest and most influential book sales chart in the UK and the one that every author wants to be on. So this chart is the most accurate and comprehensive estimation of book sales in the country. How do you know that it was Father's Day? Well, there are six books about the Second World War in the bestsellers list this week, and that doesn't include Terry Deary's A History of Britain in Ten Enemies, which has a chapter on the conflict. But there is life beyond battles. In fiction hardbacks, two new fantasy novels have entered the top 10. You can take your pick, vampires or dragons. So starting with general hardbacks, just one new entry this week. At number one is The Let Them Theory by Mel Robbins. Number two, Big Dunk by Duncan Ferguson. Number three, A Different Kind of Power by Jacinda Ardern. Number four, SAS Great Escapes 4 by Damian Lewis. Number five, Forever Forward by Ben Hunt. Number 6 this week is Ocean by David Attenborough and Colin Butfield. Number 7, Sword by Max Hastings. Number 8, My Next Breath by Jeremy Renner. Number 9 is Victory 45 by James Holland and Al Murray. And number 10 is the new entry called Voices of Victory by Geraint Thomas. Witnesses recall the final battles of the Second World War. I'm sorry, Geraint Jones, not Geraint Thomas. He's the cyclist, isn't he? Moving on to fiction hardbacks. There are two new entries this week. Number 1 being one of them, Bury Our Bones in the Midnight Soil by V.E. Schwab. The desires and dreams of a trio of women across three time periods. Number 2 is Never Flinch by Stephen King. Number 3, Atmosphere by Taylor Jenkins Reid. Number 4, A Death on Location by Richard Coles. Number 5, Nightshade by Michael Connelly. Number 6, The First Gentleman by Bill Clinton and James Patterson. Number 7 is the other new entry, Six Wild Crowns by Holly Race. Six queens married to one king face court politics, dragons and ancient magic. Number 8 is Onyx Storm by Rebecca Yarros. Number 9, By Your Side by Ruth Jones. And number 10 is Tyrant by Con Iggulden. Moving on to Amazon.co.uk, your top 10 bestsellers for this week. Number 1 is The Let Them Theory by Mel Robbins. Number 2, The Housemaid by Freda McFadden. Number 3, Cozy Corner, a calm and comforting colouring book for all ages by Coco Wyo. Number 4, The Housemaid's Secret by Freda McFadden, which I've just finished and bought the next one in the series immediately. Really great stuff. Number 5, The Women by Kristin Hannah. Number 6 is The Salt Path by Raina Wynn. Number 7, Cozy Cuties, a cute and comfy colouring book for all ages by Coco Wyo. Number 8 is Sunrise on the Reaping by Suzanne Collins. Number 9, The Greatest Story Ever Told, an eyewitness account by Bear Grylls. And number 10, The Courage to Be Disliked, a single book that can change your life by Ichiro Kashimi.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
You're listening to The Book Club on Talk Radio Europe. And keep listening. That's an instruction from Margaret Thatcher.
Joining us on the line now is Margaret Gardner. She became an international cover girl at 16, Miss Universe at 18, and ultimately the fashion editor at GoldenGlobes.com. She's worked with A-list stars from Angelina Jolie to Zendaya. She knows what it's like to be on the red carpet, in the spotlight, and what goes on behind the scenes. With a degree in psychology and a focus on diversity, equity and inclusion, her debut novel is for every woman who has ever been made to feel less. It's called Joey Superstar, and it introduces us to the world of model Joey Superstar and a whirlwind of cocaine, sex and money. It's the first in an exciting Damaged Beauty series. Welcome to the book show, Margaret.
Thank you. It's so wonderful to have this chance to talk about Joey.
Oh, it's really lovely to have you with us. And how exciting it must be. I mean, this is a new thing for you, writing novels.
It is. I have written two non-fiction books on health and beauty, but this is my first work of fiction. And really, it's a culmination of 50 years of observations of things that happen behind the spotlight, the effects of fame, the projection of what beauty does, and the accountability that women are held to that is really confining. So it's a lot of big topics wrapped up in glitter and glitz.
Yes, I mean, I have to ask you, what was it like to be called the most beautiful girl in the world at the age of 18?
You know, it's such a strange thing because, yes, that is a title that comes along with being Miss Universe. But I think that what it really does is it embodies what the typical young woman of that particular age represents. So rather than being the most beautiful, I would say a good all-rounder, you know, somebody who is health conscious, but advocates for more than the outsides. And I think as I traveled the world, I got to learn about the universality of young women. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, beauty queens are known as this vacuous image. But really, many of the women that enter are advocating for a particular mindset, inclusion, speaking up, propagating an idea that has social appeal. So it's much more than the outsides.
Yeah, interesting. And do you think that Miss Universe and similar competitions are still relevant today?
So it's so interesting. I had the good fortune to be invited back to judge Miss Universe in November of last year. And I got to talk to over 100 women from around the world. And some of the things that resonated with me were that these women have a platform. Many of us go to university, we get degrees, and we have an idea of a message we want to present. When you become Miss Universe, you have a universal platform. 2 million people who listen to you, who you can affect, who you can inspire. And a lot of people talk about judging. I have to ask you, in what field are you not judged? You're judged constantly on your ability to deliver. And Miss Universe is judged on all of those things, but also on her outsides.
Yeah. It's interesting to see how former beauty queens over the years have gone on to such varied careers.
I really think it's yours to do with as you want. You've got a year in which you make incredible contacts, but you also get to experience in a very protected way what fame is. And it's a big thing. I know the character in my book embodies aspects of fame that people don't really think about. We think that fame inures you to pain. We think that beauty is a protection and a buffer from pain. And it really isn't. You know, Kate Moss, for instance, spoke about being on billboards naked, like my protagonist is, around the world for Calvin Klein when she was 17. And she had, well, she said she had a nervous breakdown. What does it do to a young girl who is encouraged to take off her clothes and be told this is normal, and then that image is blasted around the world? What does it do to your psyche? How do people see you? What funnels of power does it give you? And what do you tell yourself when people only want to connect with your outsides and manipulate that and not really hear what you want to say or take into account what objectifying you does to your psyche? There are lots of big things. And the thing is, I've used modeling in my book to talk about issues that happen to women in everyday life. When you go out and work, there are power funnels that occur. If you're really young and you haven't yet learned how to say no, how to take agency of your body, there are pitfalls that we have to deal with. And because we don't talk about it, we think we alone are dealing with these issues. Where I think it's a universal thing. And I really want people, I want women in particular, although this does happen to men too. I want women to be able to read this book and say, you know, she's this very tough character. What did you think? Has anything like this happened to you? What would you do? And to talk to our daughters about going out into the world and understanding that we have agency.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Really interesting topics. So tell us about your main character of Joey Superstar.
Oh, my goodness. So she comes across initially as unlikable. And I've done this very particularly because so many of women's heroines are these perfect specimens. They handle trauma well. They sail through challenges. And that puts a lot of pressure on women. So I've created this woman who she's just had a miscarriage. Her husband's having affairs. And she's dealing with mental health issues. He's trying to manipulate her for reduced alimony. And a lot of women will identify with this. He wants to pay her less on a monthly basis, and he's manipulating her so that she will come across as less believable, less honorable. She ultimately ends up in a mental institution, not a mental institution, but a place to help her deal with the emotions she's going through. This is a ploy that he's done. But while she's there, for the first time, her psychologist gives her tools to question the self-damage she inflicts upon herself. And she begins to understand that what she's doing, what she thinks is okay, actually self-damages. And she goes back out into the world of modeling to reclaim her title as the superstar as she's unraveling emotionally. And her journey is one of redemption, fighting back, unpeeling the societal framing that women have to go through while, doing photo shoots, walking the red carpet, dealing with producers. There's a man who is a billionaire, who's a philanthropist, who tries to help her, who falls in love with her. She has to navigate what other people are projecting on her and emerge as she really is, and also uncover a secret that is actually the root cause of her emotional instability. She has to face her past and reclaim who she is and move ahead to the future she deserves. Oh. It's very exciting. I hope it moves people. People say that this is not a book they would have picked up, but once they do, they cannot put it down. So I think it's going to be a good summer read.
Yeah, fabulous. And it's not about you. That's important to mention. It's not autobiographical, but it is kind of inspired by some of the people that you met or events that you witness. It's set in 1980s, isn't it?
It is. So I was 16-year-old. A girl from Africa, never modeled, invited to Paris to model. And so I was totally unprepared for this world I was about to encounter, very glamorous, very exciting, but not really something I knew anything about. And some of the things I saw were very impactful. You know, when they're power funnels, we've just been through the Me Too movement, and you go, well, why don't girls just get up and leave? We look at Britney Spears and we go, this is a beautiful, talented, powerful, wealthy woman. Why is she acting like this? We don't understand how easily young girls can be manipulated, what is presented as normal. Because when you're in chaos, you go, you get very still and you go, well, what's everyone else doing? Am I the strange one or am I the odd one out? And when everybody else is doing crazy, crazy becomes normal. And this is some of the stuff. You know, I'm also an entertainment reporter, so I get to see these young girls, white hot, suddenly the next best thing, what it's like for them in the spotlight, on the red carpet, what people say to them, how they provoke them, how they have to navigate expectations, how they dressed, what's asked of them. Somebody has to be on their side and say, no, you're crossing a line. You know, there's this thing on the internet of Kate Moss being filmed. She's in a white vest and a box of shorts, and there's a man's voice off camera. And it says, oh, it's in jeans, her box of shorts. And it says to her, her jeans are kind of low on her hips. And this man's voice says, can you lower them? And she looks at him. You can see her considerate. And she says, no. And he comes back and he says, just a little. And she holds her ground. But that's what happens in front of the camera. Oh, just a little bit. You know, can you take the strap off your shoulder? Can you lower it? Can you do this? You get groomed. You get encouraged. And unless you go, no, that image is captured and shared across the world. And we look at it and we go, oh, isn't she beautiful? Isn't she glamorous? But the cost to the human, to the girl who is out there exposing herself, may not be as beautiful and glamorous as it's portrayed to be.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That's really sad. It must be so difficult for models, particularly younger models, I guess, trying to get into the industry and make a real name for themselves, feeling uncomfortable in those situations, but thinking, oh, I'd better say yes. I don't want to let them down. I want to make sure I get booked again for another job. And goodness knows what they'll do to make the photographer happy, as it were.
So there's a chapter in the book that it was so difficult to write. It was about a young girl, another model, same age as me, who thought she had to give a little to get a little. And what she allowed to happen to her. And I wrote it, and it's harsh. And I thought to myself, I can't put it in there. And then I thought, you know, no, I must, because this isn't only happening to models. This is happening to young girls in the boardroom where CEOs are looking and saying, let's take her on the trip. Let's take her to the bar. Let's, you know, give her an opportunity. and there's going to be a grey area, and women have to know how to get out of it, know that if they say yes to this, what the consequences can be. But it's not only about that. It's about self-empowerment. It's about finding your voice. It's about, rising up and saying, this is who I am. I deserve self-love. And if I love myself, I won't allow others to damage me. Mm. And what do we say to ourselves? What do we say to ourselves when something bad has happened? Women tend to say, oh, I allowed that to happen. No, this was done to us. And we've got to start saying, I don't deserve to be treated that way. And it's okay for me to draw a boundary. And that's a good thing. That's a positive thing. And we must be encouraged to self-actualize.
Mm. Oh, absolutely. Very important message. And I have to ask you, with all the interviewing that you've done on the red carpet and things, the likes of Oprah, Angelina Jolie, Barbara Streisand, I mean, some real legends there. Do you ever get starstruck?
Yes, indeed. People like Zendaya, who are so talented, so young, and so absolutely gorgeous. You encounter them and you're expecting at this stage already to be jaded. And she walks in, she looks around the room, she makes eye contact, she asks questions after the interview so that you feel seen, you feel valued. That's an incredible trait for someone in the spotlight, not only to take in, but to give out also. And she's just drop-dead gorgeous. it's like going into a museum and you see a work of art, a sculpture, and you go, it moves you. And here, this is a living human being. And she's nice also. You don't need to be awful if you're famous. You can be nice.
Yes.
And that's a real, I think being nice is an undervalued gift that not only gives to others, but gives to you, because it helps the world to be a better place. Yeah. I know that sounds very beauty queenish.
At least you didn't say world peace. You were close. Yes.
But it's a truth.
Yeah, for sure.
I've been this for over 50 years, and I know that the times that I've felt best and most energized is when I've interacted with other people and we found a commonality. Mm. This world is so full at the moment of exclusion and finding ways to separate. And I really, if anything, I want this book to remind us that when we see someone acting out, it's usually because they're in emotional trouble. And maybe instead of flipping a finger, if you give a smile, it could change another person's perspective.
Yeah. Oh, that's lovely. Well, if people want to get a copy of Joey Superstar, it's out now. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Margaret Gardner, who we've been chatting with. Margaret, there's so much more I wanted to talk to you about, but unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. So when your next book is out, please get back in touch so we can have another chat.
Thank you so much. This is the first of a trilogy. So I appreciate you making the book available on the website. You can follow me on Instagram at Margaret_Gardner. That's Gardner with an I. And the book's available and Abhisar also. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Katharina Volkmer. She was born in Germany and now lives in London, where she works for a literary agency. Her first novel, The Appointment, has been translated into over 15 languages and has been adapted for the stage and radio in several countries. She's with us on the Book Show to talk about her latest novel, Calls May Be Recorded for Training and Monitoring Purposes. It looks at Jimmy, whose sly, sharp, melancholy insights into the indignities of a world aims to eliminate the human. It'll make you laugh, weep, and never look the same way at an electric carving knife again. Welcome to the Book Show, Katharina.
Hello, it's very nice to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. And I love the, I just love the title and the front cover of your book. I think it's great and straight away intriguing. It's quite a long title, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I don't know if I'm allowed to mention the original title on the radio, but the original title was a bit rude. and so we changed it to this one. And I like it, though, because it's a phrase that we hear so often when we, you know, call all the places we have to call. And the cover is actually the French cover. So it's kind of a nice mix of things, that cover.
So how does this book differ from The Appointment? Is it a similar kind of book or very different, would you say?
I think it's quite different in terms of form, because it's a third person narrative. And that was quite deliberate, because The Appointment was a monologue. So I wanted to do something that was formally quite distinct. And I also think in content, though, there are, I mean, it all comes from my little brain, so there are overlaps. But I do think it's quite different thematically, because it looks at sort of contemporary working life, I'd say.
Mm. So tell us about the character of Jimmy.
So Jimmy is lives in London, like myself. And he's the son of an Italian immigrant, and he works in a call center, like many other people have at some point in their lives. And he deals with complaints by holidaymakers. He works for some kind of international booking agent for holidays, and we get to experience one day in his life.
And how would you kind of describe his life?
It's a bit messy, I would say. he's got lots of problems and issues, and he has, I think, quite particular ways of dealing with his problems. He lost a job that he much preferred, which was working at a funeral parlor. He was working as an actor there. And now he's stuck in this call center, and it's sort of, I think at some point in the book, people hopefully get the idea that it's probably, or it might be, his last day there. And he sort of interacts with his callers in a way that I think a lot of people would like to interact with whatever customers or clients they're facing. So he takes quite a lot of liberties, on his way towards, well, I like calling it a form of liberation. I think he seeks a form of liberation.
Mm. And do we like him? Are we, as readers, are we on his side? Do we want to see him succeed?
I like him. I think most readers quite like him, actually. I mean, he is sort of an unusual character, I would say. But I do actually find him quite, I find him quite endearing. And I think people, I think it depends whether people ever had a job like that. Like, I've worked in call centers before. I've worked at Burger King's. You know, if you've ever had a job like that, then I think you can probably relate to his frustrations, but also his melancholy, but also the kind of perverse joy you can get out of jobs like that.
Yeah.
I think.
It reminded me, I used to work in a call center, and I remember on my last day, I decided to do every call in a different accent. Like, really.
Oh, yeah, there you go. So you know.
It was great fun because they didn't know.
Oh, that's great. What kind of accents did you put on?
Well, some of them were like really silly, like stupid ones like that, as opposed to actual proper accents. It was more about just changing the shape of my face and my mouth. I think people felt sorry for me. I think maybe I sounded like that. There might have been something wrong with me, which I wasn't kind of doing intentionally. It was just a silly voice.
I like that. Like I worked in call centers twice, and the first time I worked there on my last day or the last 2 days, every time someone called, I started laughing hysterically. I couldn't. I just had to. That's when I knew I had to stop working there. It's quite. And I think I was also interested in what happens when people are invisible at work, which I find really interesting, the way we treat them, but also the sort of liberties, but also frustrations that can come with that.
And also people who are doing a kind of job that really doesn't feel like a career or a career move or something that they're, you know, proud to be doing and wanting to be doing for the rest of their life. And I think not for everybody, you know, there are some people, I mean, I enjoyed speaking to people on the phone, to be honest. So I didn't hate it. I actually really quite enjoyed it, but I didn't see it as a long-term career.
I think that you can only do that for so, I mean, some people, they last a long time, but I think most people can only do it for a while. But I think, yeah, you learn a lot about people and their lives. You learn a lot about loneliness, I think. So I think for a while it can be an interesting job. And I think, as you said, it's if you have a job that nobody really wants to have, there's a strange sort of, I think, solidarity with your colleagues, or there can be, which can be actually quite nice, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, we spend so much time at work, don't we? So much of our time at work. So it makes a difference, the job that we're doing and the people that we're working with.
Yeah, apparently I read something the other day that scientists think it has a huge impact on who we are and how we develop and on our personality. So it actually has, it has a huge influence on our lives. And we often spend more time with our colleagues than with our partners. Well, so it's sort of, those are, whether we want it or not, but I think those are quite significant relationships in our lives, no?
Yeah, definitely. And I have to ask you about the electric carving knife. Unless it's a spoiler, how does that come into the book?
So that for me is, again, that's something that some people can immediately connect with and others have no idea what I'm talking about. But my grandmother had an electric carving knife, and Jimmy's grandmother had an electric carving knife as well. And for me, it's just a symbol of a certain generation of women who, you know, often were forced to, you know, do all the work at home. And at some point they came up with all these stupid gadgets. And I think the electric carving knife was one of them. I don't know. I was always fascinated by it as a, you know, when I was a child. And here it gets put to a rather unusual use, I would say. I don't want to spoil it too much. But for me, it's something I would, I don't know, expect to find at a design museum or something. You know, I think it's one of those objects that define a certain generation. I think. Now people don't really have them anymore, I think, but back then.
No, that's true. I can't remember the last time I saw one. We never had one, but I remember seeing them on television and thinking, wow, they must be really good. Were they not that effective then?
I think they are quite messy and not that precise. They're also quite noisy, and the one my grandmother had was also quite ugly. But you know, I think they came up with, instead of actually changing the lives and circumstances of these women, they came up with all these stupid, yeah, gadgets for the household, you know, like things that would make it easier to open tea machines or egg boilers, you know, all of those, that I find quite interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Well, if people want to get a copy of Calls May Be Recorded for Training and Monitoring Purposes, it's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Katharina Volkmer, who we've been chatting with today. Katharina, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Jodie Cooksley, who studied literature at Oxford Brookes University and has a master's in Victorian poetry. Her debut novel, The Glass House, is a fictional account of the life of 19th century photographer Julia Margaret Cameron. She's with us on the book show to talk about her latest novel, The Surgeon's House, which brings her fascination with the dark Victorian period to life again in her latest thrilling gothic historical mystery. Welcome to the book show, Jodie.
Thank you very much, Anna. That makes me sound quite dark and creepy. I am quite fascinated with those elements of Victorian life. In case readers are worried, my books always do have happy endings.
Oh, good to know. And where does that fascination come from? Do you know?
I really think that it's come from my original BA was actually a combination of literature and physical anthropology. So that side of evolution, and the studying of, you know, kind of 19th century science and evolution, I was really fascinated by it. And I went to a lot of museums, and was quite fascinated by the curation of some of those exhibits in the museums. In fact, in this small museum, I've used some of the exhibit names as the chapter titles, because it was just such an extraordinary time, that sort of dawn of understanding. And there was a lot of competition, a lot of cutthroat competition to sort of win at science. And I think I draw very similar parallels between what was going on with them and what happens to us now with the whole technological revolution. I think we can investigate the same types of behaviours.
Yeah, interesting. It's fascinating finding those parallels, isn't it, from something that was, or a period of time that was such a long time ago, and compare it to now.
Yeah, I think they really are themes that resonate very strongly with contemporary life. That sort of the themes of patriarchal oppression and that tension between scientific progress and morality or humanity, and that sort of enduring impact of trauma. They're all in there. They're all in there to be discussed. And actually, I am very at home writing in the Victorian period, and I do think you can discuss them a little bit more openly when you look at them historically.
Yeah, that makes sense. So tell us about the setting of this new novel, The Surgeon's House. Who is the surgeon?
So the surgeon is a pretty evil Dr. Everly, who was one of the original characters from the Small Museum. So this is actually a sequel to the Small Museum. And it sort of, I realised that when I'd finished writing it, I wasn't quite done with some of those characters. So The Surgeon's House begins with a murder. It begins with the murder of the cook at Evergreen House, which is a place of refuge for women and children. It's the characters from the Small Museum who have found a safe space. And then suddenly they realise that the evil Dr. Everly and his kind of malign influence of his family is beginning to seep back into their lives. And it becomes a bit of a mystery because we're not too sure which of the characters is being manipulated by Grace, who's Dr. Everly's daughter, who is incarcerated in a madhouse.
Gosh. So tell us more about this house then, and who lives there and why.
So this proprietor is Rebecca Harris, who is the person who kind of kicked off all of the things that happened in the Small Museum, really. And then all of the kind of fallen women that were collected throughout the first novel, they live there, and they've made a sort of place of peace for themselves. Their children live there with them. It's a bit like Dickens' Urania House. I don't know if you've heard of the way that Charles Dickens tried to create a safe space for women who were kind of lambasted for having children before marriage in the Victorian time. So it's based on the tenets of Urania House, but it has this kind of malign and legacy of the Everly family, which is trying to disrupt all the happiness that they've created.
Mm. So the fact that a murder happens at the beginning, are we trying to work out who did it throughout the book?
Absolutely, but it's not the only murder. Spoiler alert. So I did actually play a lot more with the kind of crime elements of this story. I've never really previously thought of myself as a crime writer, but I was quite confused when I was encouraged to join the Crime Writers Association until they said, someone's on trial for murder in chapter two of your book and there's a murder in chapter one of your second. I was like, yeah, okay, maybe they are a bit crime.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, that all the publishers and agents and things, they all need to put books into categories. Everything has to be categorised, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, and there are some very dark elements in these books, but they, as I said, they are mysteries as well, and they do have happy endings. There's a lot of real intense kind of character development. There's a lot of recovery of characters in these, so they're not standard crime novels. They're a bit more of the gothic, really, where all of the action happens in the characters' heads. So you feel very drawn towards the things that they're going to. You're scared of the things that they're scared of. And a lot of that is kind of psychological drama.
Yeah. And do you plan your books? Do you have a clear idea of the story before you start and work out where you're going, or do you just start writing?
I am so much more professional now than I was when I wrote my first book. I'm on book number seven at the moment, and I definitely plot plan very carefully now, which makes the writing a lot easier. But with The Small Museum, that was a story that kind of came to me in a dream, and I just started writing that, which meant that it needed editing a lot more times. Whereas with The Surgeon's House, I did plot plan that very carefully before writing, and it was a much easier book to write as a result.
That's interesting. So you've definitely learned along the way of what to do and what not to do when it comes to writing.
Absolutely. And I think writing is like anything else. I think you just get better at it the more you practice. I'm a journalist by trade. So I'm very comfortable with deadlines and making myself sit at the desk and actually meet those deadlines. And I think a lot of former journalists do become novelists because it's that discipline and that sheer, you know, ability to just sit down and practice writing and churn out a lot of words, I think is very helpful.
Yeah. So do you have a book of ideas for future books, or do you just, once you've finished a book, then you start thinking about the next book?
No, I've got three in my head at the moment. it does actually take a long time to sort of, I call it a process of composting. So you have a vague idea of what you want from a story, and then over months and months and months of note taking, it begins to take shape, and it begins to have, I always kind of start with the themes, and then it begins to take shape with the characters and how you're going to actually move through those themes. But I would say I probably compost and plot plan for about 6 months before I start writing something.
Wow. But that works for you. That makes a lot of sense now.
It does. My children laugh at me because I have literally no sense of direction when I'm driving. And I always say it's because I've got three books in my head.
Oh, brilliant. Well, if people want to get a copy of The Surgeon's House, it's out now. It's available on our website, tre.radio. It's by Jodie Cooksley, who we've been chatting with today. Jodie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Hannah. Great to chat.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Talk Radio Europe.
Your voice in Spain.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Welcome to the second part of tonight's book show. In the first hour, we were chatting with Margaret Gardner, Katharina Volkmer and Jodie Cooksley. In this hour, we're joined by Caroline Madden, an Irish journalist and writer. Her debut novel, The Marriage Vendetta, is a hilariously dark take on what a woman who's had her buttons pushed one too many times might end up doing. Then we're chatting to Shirley Rusak-Wachtel, who's the daughter of Holocaust survivors and was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York. For the past 35 years, she's taught English literature at Middlesex College in New Jersey. Her podcast, Extraordinary People, features inspiring individuals who have overcome obstacles to make a difference. The Baker of Lost Memories is an epic novel spanning decades and is about the broken bonds of family, memories of war, and redemption and hope in the face of heartbreaking loss. We're also chatting to Polly Clark, who was born in Canada and grew up in Scotland. Her debut novel, Larchfield, fictionalised a little-known period in the life of W.H. Auden. She's also the author of four collections of poetry, one of which was shortlisted for the T.S. Eliot Prize. Her latest novel, Ocean, is a powerful exploration of the uncharted waters of the human heart. The story takes us on a gripping, beautifully written voyage into the depths of what it means to heal and to live. Finally on tonight's book show is Hazel Hitchens, who spends her days having conversations with her imaginary friends, some of which she writes down. Babs and Aggie, the good, the bad, and the vegan, follows a cardigan-wearing, graying cafe owner who's also a fearsome thousand-year-old witch. It's raucous, rowdy, heart-wrenching, and heartwarming in equal measures. Tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe, something for everyone.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you, only you can let it in. No one else, no one else can speak the words on your lips. Treat yourself in words unspoken, live your life.
Joining us on the line now is Caroline Madden. She's an Irish journalist and writer who's just brought out her debut novel, The Marriage Vendetta. It's a hilariously dark tale on what a woman who's had her buttons pushed one too many times might end up doing. Welcome to the book show, Caroline.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you so much for asking me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's great to have you with us. And congratulations on your debut novel. Very exciting.
It is so exciting. And I think it's probably especially exciting for me because I have been trying to get published for so long. Probably, I suppose I started writing fiction nearly 20 years ago and wrote three full novels, and I've had lots of different literary agents and I'd say hundreds of rejections. So it really means an awful lot to me now to have a book, a novel out in the world.
Oh, absolutely. Gosh, that must have been so hard getting all those rejections. What made you keep going?
Well, I think it was actually this story of a real, the story that inspired my novel, The Marriage Vendetta. There was something about this woman that I found out about called Eliza Linley. She was a very celebrated soprano in the 18th century, and she was born in Bath, and she lived on the Royal Crescent. People might be familiar with that beautiful landmark there in Bath. And I actually wrote her story as a historical novel and got an agent and everything, but it just was lacking something. And it was all about the very difficult relationship she had with the Irish playwright Richard Brinsley Sheridan. It was a bit of a doomed relationship, and in the end, one of my many literary agents said to me, you know, the problem with this story is that it's just too sad. The ending is too sad. And so there's nothing I could really do about the real life ending. So I decided eventually, after many years, to rewrite it in a modern setting in Dublin, where I live. and to turn it into a darkly humorous take. And I was also then able to give Eliza an ending that was, I felt, more fitting to such a special woman, and to remember and bring back to life this amazing woman who was one of history's forgotten women.
Oh, wow. What a great idea. So tell us about the real story, can you, for those of us who don't know?
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely amazing. I mean, it had so much drama that I couldn't believe I couldn't get it published as a historical novel. So Eliza Linley was extremely, probably the most talented soprano of her age. She was hugely famous, and she had a very pushy showbiz father. And he put her to work, I think, at the age of 9. And she sang for the king. She sang for royalty. And she was paid, her father was paid huge amounts of money. But the pressure got to her. And by the time, I think she was probably 16 or 17, she was on the verge of a full breakdown. It was kind of like a historical Britney Spears type situation. She was under way too much pressure. She was taking, I think, secretly taking laudanum to dull the stress. But she was at cracking point. And at that point, her friend said to her, "My brother could sort this out for you." And her brother was a penniless young Irishman called Richard Brinsley Sheridan, who is now very, very famous. He went on to become a very successful playwright and then politician. And he rose to the highest levels of society in England. But at the time, he was penniless. And he said, I can save you, Eliza. And so they hatched this plan where he was going to whisk her away from Bath in the middle of the night to a convent in northern France, where she would be safe from, she was subject to a lot of sexual harassment as well. So she'd be safe from men. She wouldn't have to work in the same pressured environment of public performances. And it was a convent that concentrated on music. And so it sounded like a dream come true to her. And so they ran away together in the middle of the night in a carriage from the Royal Crescent in Bath. And if you go there, you can see a plaque on the wall that commemorates that moment, but it does say it was an elopement, but it actually wasn't. They weren't romantically involved at that point, but I think Richard had a little plan of his sleeve. And she was so weak at the time, she got very, very sick on the ferry crossing, not the ferry crossing, but the ship crossing to France. And he nursed her back to health, and she fell in love with his kindness, and they never got to the convent. And then they got married. They came back and he fought two duels on her behalf, which is, even though she didn't want him to. He was just determined to be this hero, even though she didn't want him to. And this made his name. So he was in all the papers as this Romeo, this hero. But one of the first things he did when they got married was he banned her from ever returning to the stage. Which was unfortunate. On one hand, yes, she was stressed from all the performing, but she would have been in control of her own performance schedule. And, you know, she wanted to return to the stage. Plus, they had no money. So she said, you know, I can earn a huge living for us. But he wouldn't allow it because he said he knew that he would not be considered a gentleman in English high society if his wife was on the stage. And so he never let her return to the stage, and she never did, which is a huge loss to her and, you know, to society, really, and to history. And you see, the reason it was so tragic, and my historical version was so tragic, is that she died 37 and they were pretty much living separate lives at that point. And he mistreated her terribly. He had loads of affairs. It was awful, really. But he did repent at the end, but it was too late. He did see the error of his ways and was sorry for how he treated her. But in the modern version, I have changed it so that she gets more agency. She takes matters into her own hands a little bit more. But I won't spoil the ending.
No.
But it's a much more uplifting ending.
Oh, nice one. And you've kept the character names as well, Eliza and Richard.
I decided to, yeah. Because even though they spent most of their lives in England, in London, there are a lot of connections to Dublin, where I've set it. Richard's father ran a theatre here. And a lot of Richard's plays are still staged here. I went to see one of them a few years ago in a theatre here. And he is remembered. And then when my book was launched a few weeks ago, in a bookshop on Grafton Street, which is one of Dublin's biggest shopping streets. It was in a bookshop opposite a building where Richard had gone to primary school. So there's a lot of nice connections to the original characters, which I liked.
Oh, that's lovely. So tell us about the setting then for this, for your story.
Well, the setting I picked was a kind of leafy, well-heeled Dublin suburb near the city centre, because I had worked for a long time as a business journalist during the Celtic Tiger era, Ireland's boom times, before we had an economic collapse. And so I had written about and met a lot of these high flyers, and I wanted to bring a little bit of that experience in as well. And how the corporate scene in Dublin, big businesses, big corporations, interact with theatres here is actually quite interesting. And so I wanted to bring a little bit of that in, this affluence and the sort of strange connection it has then to cultural events. And they sort of buy these special tickets for their clients where you get access to actors after their performances and things like that, which I always think is just a little bit, it's a bit of a strange relationship. So I wanted to bring in a little bit of that and how Eliza doesn't fit in with that scene at all. She's a retired, in the book I've made her a former concert pianist. She's just totally at odds with this high glamour lifestyle that she's landed into, and she's not fitting in at all. And she's missing her old life as a touring concert pianist as well. So I wanted to show that as well.
Yeah. So I'm dying to know that, I know you're not going to tell us, but what I said in the beginning, what a woman who's had her buttons pushed one too many times might end up doing. I'm like, what's she going to do?
Yes. Yeah.
That's a big spoiler, I assume.
But I suppose I could say what she does set off down this path that probably is a bit unwise, but she's tempted. So she goes along to an unorthodox marriage counsellor, marriage therapist, who advises her against the traditional advice that you would normally get from a marriage counsellor, which is things like better communication and, I don't know, date nights or something. So she said, no, that's all nonsense. What you need to do is to follow this very strange but effective treatment plan that she has come up with, and she says has been highly effective for all her other clients, and that she guarantees to Eliza will fix her marriage, because Eliza has discovered a photo of Richard with another woman. She wants to fix things. But the therapist says, under no circumstances can you tell your husband what you're doing. And so she pushes Eliza further and further out of her comfort zone into borderline illegal, I would say, treatments. Unbeknownst to poor Richard, who is asking for it, but at the same time, you know, we don't want people breaking the law to save their marriages. So it, the book does come with a warning that this treatment plan has not been tested in real life.
And it's not recommended marriage advice.
Yeah. But it was inspired, I mean, not that this woman would advise that type of thing, but the therapist, I did take some inspiration from a podcast that I love. It's a Belgian-American marriage therapist or psychotherapist called Esther Perel. And I think it's called Where Shall We Begin? And you can listen to real-life couples getting marriage counselling with her. Which is it sounds a bit creepy when I say it now, but it is, from the point of view of a writer, it's fascinating, you know. And she has a very stern attitude, and she gets annoyed with her clients. And I thought that it was very refreshing to hear someone so brutal with her clients, or so frank and honest with them, rather than tiptoeing around and teaching to have better communication, whatever that means. So I wanted to bring a little bit of that into the therapist character.
Yeah, great fun. And you obviously enjoyed writing it. I mean, have you tried to work out and understand why this book and this story got published and got interest compared to all the others? Have you thought, right, I've cracked it now. I know what to do with the next book.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, I have figured out quite a lot of things as to why this one got published when the others got turned down. The others, apart from the sad ending, the most common feedback was they were too quiet. And I think that's something that often happens. And actually, I was speaking with an editor last week about this, is that people focus on the writing, the beautiful writing. And I often got comments back like, oh, the writing's lovely, but it's just too quiet. It didn't quite grab me. And so what I concentrate first and foremost is on tension and the story and telling a story that will resonate with people, rather than having in my mind, oh, I want great reviews saying how luscious and gorgeous and lyrical the prose is. So I put all that out of my mind and try instead to have a memorable character who's in a very difficult situation, but she's fighting back in her own way. And hopefully then, by having such a specific type of person, that it will resonate with people who are reading it. So you're doing it not for, you know, the praise and the good reviews or anything. You're doing it to try and connect with readers. And the other thing then that was very different is that I brought in dark humour. And that really was something that I know editors liked when they read it. That made a big difference. It kind of stood out and drew them in. So, yeah. So I think that those are a couple of things that made a big difference.
Yeah, that's great. So have you already got an idea for the next book?
Yeah, I'm working away on book two, and I am enjoying it. I'm not very far into it, but basically to sum it up, it's called The Village, and it's this first novel, The Marriage Vendetta, is, I suppose you could call it a darkly comic feminist novel, and the Village is too, although maybe more of a thriller. And it's based around a secretive community that has been designed specifically around the needs of mothers looking after children. And so it's a utopia for mothers and a very much a guarded community that very few outsiders are allowed into. And so the novel asks the question, how far would these women be willing to go to protect this feminist utopia? And so I think quite far will be the answer. But it's good fun. I'm enjoying writing it.
Yeah, sounds great. Well, in the meantime, if listeners want to get a copy of The Marriage Vendetta, it's available now on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Caroline Madden, who we've been chatting with today. Caroline, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Hannah. It's been absolutely lovely chatting with you. Thank you.
Hello, little Alan Bennett here. If I'm not writing books, then the thing I like most is listening to the book club on Talk Radio Europe. Fancy.
Joining us on the line now is Shirley Rusak-Wachtel. She is the author of A Castle in Brooklyn. She's the daughter of Holocaust survivors and was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York. For the past 35 years, she's taught English literature at Middlesex College in Edison, New Jersey. Her podcast, Extraordinary People, features inspiring individuals who have overcome obstacles to make a difference. She's with us on the book show to talk about her epic novel, spanning decades. It is about the broken bonds of family, memories of war, and redemption and hope in the face of heartbreaking loss. It's called The Baker of Lost Memories, and it's set in Brooklyn in the 60s and 70s. Welcome to the book show, Shirley.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you with us. So I understand this book is more about the reverberations of lost in the second generation.
Yes, that's right. My first book, A Castle in Brooklyn, was about the plight of Holocaust survivors and their struggle to become real American citizens and build a home in America. And all along, they seem to be haunted by those tragic memories that they've had, and they find difficulty adjusting to this new life that they so desperately wanted. In this book, I talk about the second generation. That's what I focus on mostly. And that's like myself, because I am a child of survivors. And most people don't really think about the children experiencing any kind of trauma or feeling of loss. But I think we really do. And I think what I try to do is to show this through the character of Lena, who really is desperate to fill that loss in her parents' hearts, the loss they had for of their sister, of her, Lena's sister, Ruby, who did not make it out.
Mm. Yeah, it's fascinating how trauma can be passed down through generations, isn't it?
Yes, it is. If I might, I'd like to tell you a little bit about my personal story.
Yeah.
A lot of the book is kind of based on that. My parents came from Poland. My father was one of five. He was grown when the war began, and he lived in the Lodz ghetto. And in the book, I have Joseph and Anya living in the Lodz ghetto and owning a bakery there. My father, during the war, was a runner for the black market, and he was really a hero. I found out only when I was a little girl, when people would come up to him, strangers, and they'd hug him and say, thanks for saving my life. And so Joseph is also a runner in the black market, and he's quite heroic, I think. When the Lodz ghetto was dispersed, my father was sent to Auschwitz. Unlike Joseph, my father was not married and, of course, had no children. And when he was going to Auschwitz, he was selected. You know, they had the selections, whether a person looked healthy enough to continue to work or they could, they were sent to the gas. And my father was a slight man, and he was supposed to be on the line for death. And he didn't like the looks of it. So when people weren't looking, when the guards were turned away, he ran to the line for life. And I always say, if not for that fast decision, I would not be here today, nor would my children or my grandchildren. So, and at the end of it, when he was liberated, he found, he had word that one sister was alive. He had a mother and he had, four siblings. And when she had food poisoning, and when he went to her in Paris, actually, at the hospital, she had just passed away. So he was the only survivor in his family. My mother lived in Dąbrowa, Poland, and there were nine in her family at the time, and she was just taken from her home. She actually worked in a bakery, and I guess perhaps that and my love of sweets inspired me to write about bakeries. And she worked at a labor camp and learned to sew there. And through the kindness of one of the guards, she was fed regularly and she survived, went on to Bergen-Belsen. And at war's end, she was just a little bit luckier than my father was. It was her and two brothers. And she actually met my father after the displacement camp. And like my characters, they sought a new life, a better life, and certainly in America, and certainly a better life for their children. And that's what Anya and Joseph do, only their hurts were perhaps a little deeper because of the loss of their one daughter. And, Lena spends her early years trying, as I said, to make up for that. But she really is broken too. And as much as she tries, she has this awful feeling of isolation. And she finds that she can't seem to live up to the standards that she thinks her parents hold for her, especially her mother. And she confides in her friend Pearl, in her one friend. And, there are problems, a lot of problems ensue.
Gosh, amazing stories about your parents. Thank you for sharing. How brave your father was to just run from where he was to join the life queue. That's amazing.
Yes. Gosh. You know, a minute can, you know, a second can change one's entire life and future.
Yeah, absolutely. And it must be very, interesting for you, I suppose that's one word to use, to be so connected to these stories, you know, in your family. They're stories that we learn about in history books, that we read about in books, that we watch in films, but this happened to your parents, you know, this is your family. Does that really bring you closer to what happened during the war and make it all that more real to you?
It does. It does. You know, I wouldn't say I had a normal childhood. How many of us really have a so-called normal childhood?
Yeah, what does that even mean?
Right. And you know, we had the basics. We always had food. We always had warm clothing. I was always in the frame of mind trying to please my parents. You know, I felt, and I think in some way, like my character Lena, that my parents, being one of the very few to survive, were given a gift. And I, in part, I was also given that gift. So therefore, I felt this need to be the best that I can, to really excel in whatever I did, to make them proud, and certainly never to inflict any pain on my parents. And I would say many of us children of survivors are similar in that way. We value this country. We feel that education is the key to success. And yet the other side of that coin is the fear of what might happen. You know, I look at the world today and I think, oh my God, I think in some ways we are like pre-war Europe and pre-war Poland in the things I say or I see around me. And I fear for really for my children, especially for my grandchildren, as to what the future can bring. But I think it's so important to speak up, to see these weaknesses in society, to see society perhaps going in the wrong direction, to be aware of it, not to close our eyes to it. And I think we kind of have to impart that lesson to the coming generations, because this will be their world, and we want to hand them the best world that we can, I think.
Oh, definitely. Yes, it is frightening to think that there are similar things happening now that happened pre-war. Absolutely.
Sure. And you know, and I never quite felt in place because my parents were immigrants. They were different from the, you know, they spoke differently. They acted differently. I wasn't sent to, you know, ballet schools, or I wasn't, you know, we didn't have go out to restaurants a lot and things like that. And you learn to cherish what you have, you know, and that was very important. And I think this desire, which my character, you know, shares, to be the best, you know, I think Lena goes off the track a little bit in that desire. And towards the end, we kind of see how she's been damaged mentally, I think, as a result. But the results can be good, too, because there's success, there's accomplishment. And I think most of all, anyone could say, you know, your parents went through this. Of course, you're pessimistic about the world. And I've never been a pessimistic person. I've always believed in a better future, even when things look bleak. And I think that idea also plays out in my novel.
Yeah, nice. And do you think that people will like Lena? Is the idea that we like her and we can relate to her and sympathize with her?
I hope so. I hope they like Lena. All children have fears. They don't have to be children of survivors to have those fears. And children, I believe, will have this innate desire to please their parents. And so I think and I hope they can relate to Lena, relate to even some of the problems that she has, the choices that she makes with her life, and ultimately how she handles those choices.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if people want to get a copy of The Baker of Lost Memories, it's out now. It's by Shirley Rasak-Wachtel, and it's available on our website, tre.radio. Shirley, thank you so much for joining us. Lovely to chat with you.
Thank you.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Polly Clark. She was born in Canada and brought up in Scotland. Her debut novel, Larchfield, fictionalised a little-known period in the life of poet W.H. Auden. She's also the author of four collections of poetry, one of which was shortlisted for the T.S. Eliot Prize. She divides her time between the west of Scotland and a houseboat in London. She's with us on The Book Show to talk about her new novel, Ocean. It's a powerful exploration of the uncharted waters of the human heart. The book takes us on a gripping, beautifully written voyage into the depths of what it means to heal and to live. Welcome to The Book Show, Polly.
Hello, it's lovely to be here. Thank you for that introduction.
A pleasure. It's great to have you with us. And gosh, this sounds like a great novel. Lots of different subjects tackled in it.
Well, yes. I mean, I've got the sort of the frame and the adventure of a sea voyage. They're trying to cross the Atlantic in a boat. And that was a way of talking about and exploring the other things that had happened to the main character, Helen. So she's suffered a really traumatic experience of being caught up in a terrorist explosion in the London Underground. And it just has a massive ongoing impact on her relationships and her marriage. And I follow all that through. And then it seemed that actually taking it out onto the vastness of the ocean itself allowed me to explore it in a different way. So, yes, I did. I got all those things in, and it was actually the ocean side of it that really brought it all together.
Mm. So there's a lot of metaphors there with the ocean and what's going on in her life.
Yes, it allows me to do it like that, but it's also very real. So, I mean, I actually took a trip across the Bay of Biscay crewing, although I can't sail. I did do that because I wanted to keep it, you know, very real, very anchored in what it is actually like to be on a boat at sea. So she's emotionally at sea, but then she's really at sea. And that meant that it did work as a metaphor because it has to be very real in order to really work as a metaphor. Otherwise, it's just a huge mess of imaginations, you know.
Yeah. So tell us a bit more about Helen and what she's like as a person.
I mean, I describe her as a sort of maverick. She's a teacher in an inner city London school, and she has a very kind of unconventional approach to her teaching. She's very attuned to the emotional lives of her students. They're from the poor, the rough end of things, and she's very attuned to that. And her approach isn't to kind of educate them out of it. She starts doing things that she calls interventions, where she actually gets the other pupils to, I mean, I won't spoil what she does because it is quite magical, but she gets the pupils all together to kind of address each other's inner lives as a way of forming connections among them, because a lot of these kids that she's got, that's what they don't have, connection. They're very isolated from difficult home backgrounds, and her method is to kind of break through to them in that way. So she's an unusual person, and her approach to things is unusual. And so when all these very real things happen to her, it's interesting to see how she brings that all to bear on her own problems. I found it fascinating to kind of follow what she did, yeah, and how she mentally coped with these things, given how she dealt with children in her care.
Mm. And how did she end up on this boat?
So after this has happened to her, obviously the strain on, you know, the strain on her marriage is enormous, and she becomes obsessed with the man who saved her from this explosion. He actually saved her life and then disappeared, and she sort of becomes obsessed with finding him, and her husband doesn't really know what to do, and he manages to find the boat that they met on and actually got married on. So when they were young, they were crewing around the Mediterranean and sort of just as young people do. He managed to find that boat, and they go to sail the Atlantic on that boat. And he imagines that as a way of healing the past. That's his idea. For, you know, they get away from everything, they get away from society, and they go back in time in a way on the boat where they were happy. So that's how they end up on the Innisfree. And that was something I was very interested in. Can you really do that? Boats are very, very powerful things. They're very, you know, they're not just vessels. They're invested with people's hopes and dreams, and they're much more than just homes. So I wanted to see if that would work. Can you really heal a marriage and heal yourself after something so terrible by revisiting a time when you were completely happy?
Mm, interesting question. Did you feel like you came up with a definitive answer, or do you think it would really depend on the people?
I mean, I suppose that's what kind of what I'm doing in my novels. It's a question I don't have the answer to, and I'm almost writing the book to find out the answer. Yes, I think there's an answer in there. It's not the one. It's not the obvious one. It's not a yes or a no. It's more complicated than that. But I do think that, just sort of learned that myself, that boats and being out at proper sea and blue water sailing, something does happen to time, really. You're not really caught up in the straightforward linear time that runs our lives onshore. You really do touch on something different, and that does give a kind of hope for a different way of being.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how many other people are on the boat with them? Is it just the two of them, or have they got a crew and staff?
No, they've got their son, Nicholas, who's 11 at the time of the trip, and also their foster daughter, Cindy, who's one of her pupils and the one that had sort of troubled her the most. And by a certain set of events, she ends up coming with them. So, of course, that has various implications.
And did you enjoy the writing of the book? Did you know where it was going when you first started it?
Well, no, not at all. I didn't. And it's taken 6 years. I mean, it spans a lot of, you know, so I was writing it over COVID. I had to fit in this trip. And I began with in early scenes where Helen's on the underground, and that part of it, I had that very, very clear in my mind, but I didn't have the rest of it at all. And I didn't know how it would turn out. And the trip itself changed the novel as it's supposed to do, because I learned so much about what, such a trip involves and what sailing involves and that sort of thing. So I had done research for my previous novel, Tiger, I actually went to Siberia in order to kind of understand what I was writing about. And that changed the novel completely. And in the same way, the novel was changed completely by the fact of actually taking the trip. And then I was able to finish the novel once I'd done the trip and I understood how the two parts related, because I didn't for a long time. You're just writing on faith a lot of the time. You know, you're convinced in yourself there must be a reason why I'm putting these two very different things together, and it's an act of faith. So it took 6 years, and it was an intense business writing a novel. So I wouldn't say yes, I enjoy it, but when there's probably no greater pleasure in life if you're a writer than the actual process of writing when it's going well. But that's not the shape of your days normally. Yeah.
Lovely that you're able to take that trip, though, because that obviously makes a huge difference when you're writing. If you were just doing research on the internet, which a lot of people do and a lot of people do well, but talking about the trip like this to actually do it gave you a whole different understanding of what it was really like.
Absolutely. It depends what you're doing. I mean, for instance, a really good example, Samantha Harvey's book Orbital that won the Booker last year. So that's set on the International Space Station with a lot of astronauts and everything. I actually interviewed her for an event because I was very, it's so vivid that you almost think, sure, obviously she didn't go up there, but, you know, it had that feel. And what she had done was basically immerse herself in NASA archives for a couple of years. But her novel is not really character-driven. I mean, it does have lovely characters in it, but it's a different undertaking than mine, which are very much emotional stories of people doing something and feeling things. And I couldn't really replicate that, because you don't know what it feels like to be on the ocean in a storm and how that impacts on your relationship with other people, unless you've done that. That for me anyway, I could have researched it, but it would have lacked something, I think, a depth.
Yeah.
Or it would have just been a different book. You know, I think for the, it really is just the types of book that I write that are so character driven. It made all the difference in the world, and I felt I inhabited their journey rather than writing it for them. I actually inhabited what they inhabited.
Yeah, lovely. Well, if people want to get a copy of Ocean, it's out now. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Polly Clark, who we've been chatting with today. Polly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Hazel Hitchens, who spends her days having conversations with her imaginary friends, some of which she writes down. When not wrestling her own stories into submission, she helps other writers with theirs in her Book Forge group. She's with us on the Book Show to talk about her novel Babs and Aggie, The Good, the Bad and the Vegan. It's a raucous, rowdy and heart-wrenching and heartwarming book in equal measures. The story follows a cardigan-wearing, greying cafe owner who is also a fearsome thousand-year-old witch. Welcome to the Book Show, Hazel.
Hello, thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. And what a lovely idea for a story, and I love the title as well.
Yes, it kind of came, I had the idea of these two older ladies, kind of almost like their last stand, although I'm very pleased to say it won't be their last stand. There is a lot more that these two have left to say. So, yes.
Great. So tell us about the characters of Babs and Aggie.
Well, they were very much inspired by, there's a short story by Joanne Harris called Faith and Hope Go Shopping, about two residents of a nursing home who escape for the day and find themselves treated like humans, basically, in a world where they've been very much faded into the background. And it made me think, I grew up reading fantasy stories, and all the women in fantasy stories, while the men were allowed to be kind of the old greying wizards, the women always had to be, even if they were millennia old, they had to be glorious and, you know, beautiful Galadriels and Polgaras and timeless. It's as if aging was the worst thing that could happen.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I started reading Terry Pratchett in my late 20s when all of a sudden there were witches who felt real, who felt like you could bump into them on the street, even though he was talking about a different world. And that's what appealed to me, was having characters who, even though they were supernatural, they felt natural. They felt as if we could relate to them. They could be us. And Aggie, certainly at the beginning, Aggie is very much us. She has had centuries of bringing kings and common folk alike to their knees, of taking absolutely no nonsense. But she is at a point in her life when, due to various circumstances, she's just not feeling it. She is at a very low ebb, and she's been brought to her knees by someone who historically she would have chewed up and spat out. And that's the point when we have Babs coming in. And these two are characters from folklore. Aggie is Black Annis from Leicestershire folklore, who in that folklore is a blue-faced, iron-clawed hag who would eat humans and steal your children away. And Babs is Baba Yaga from obviously Eastern European folklore, who apparently would do the same thing. And I just wanted a reimagining of them as not monsters, as ordinary people who are just have friendships and have a life, albeit one that is considerably longer than the normal human lifespan.
So what world is this set in?
This is in our world. This is the here and now. It is set in a contemporary suburban cafe, such as you might find on any high street.
Okay.
So
it's just the fact that the women are hundreds of years old.
Yes. So they're not the usual people. They're not everyone on the street. Not everybody on the street is hundreds of years old. They are just living amongst us, and they happen to be hundreds of years old.
So does everybody else know that?
No.
Okay. No. Interesting. So where does the good, the bad and the vegan come from?
So, again, drawing on kind of Westerns of these two women making a stand, the vegan in it is a fake vegan. He is the villain of the piece. It is in no way anti-vegan. There is even a line, which I will paraphrase so as not to use bad language, but they are asked if they are anti-vegan. And the reply is, no, we've got nothing against vegans. It's bleep holes we don't like. So it's just basically they will accept anybody as long as they are a decent person.
Mm-hmm.
But this person is, the villain is manipulative, and he is calling himself vegan to manipulate other people, which becomes clear in the book. But he isn't a real vegan. He is trying to shut down all the shops in the little arcade where Aggie's shop is.
So do we like Babs and Aggie? Are we kind of rooting for them?
We love Babs and Aggie. We absolutely love Babs and Aggie. Aggie, as I said, is all of us. Babs is the person we all secretly wish we could be. She's that school friend who would get us into trouble for talking, but then come along to the detention we got because she wouldn't have us go through it alone. She's audacious and outrageous and impulsive, and she's also fiercely loyal and feels a lot more keenly than she lets on. And yes, she is in awe of Aggie. Not that she lets Aggie know that initially, but she knows how Aggie should be and is determined to get her friend back to how she should be.
Okay. And what's the cafe like? What kind of people come into the cafe? Is that significant?
The cafe is there for everyone. It's part of an arcade, and in this arcade we have other characters. We have Sophie, who is actually a vegan, and she is the villain vegan's girlfriend. We like Sophie. There is Bert, who runs a fruit and veg shop and has magnificent plums, as Babs keeps commenting. we very much like Bert. Bert is Babs's love interest because, again, just because she's an older lady, there's no reason why she shouldn't have a love interest.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, and there are a couple of people within there. There is a secondary villain called... She's given two names, and I'll use the tamer of the two names, which is Little Miss Magic. And she runs a kind of pagan gift shop and uses the kind of the idea of being a witch for her own needs, even though she's not actually one. She's just peddling crystals, really. she is in cahoots to some extent with the vegan. And yes, we have this whole host creating a little world of these people who are up against the bully. And I think that's part of the charm of the book and why it's been so well received by a lot of people, is it's the right book for the right time. If you look out at the world at the moment, it feels like we are surrounded by bullies in charge. So I think the idea of having a pair of older ladies march up to the bullies and say, "Pack it in. No, I don't care who started it. I'm finishing it. Stop." I think that appeals to people.
Definitely, definitely. So you kind of implied at the beginning that there might be a sequel, more stories about Babs and Aggie?
There will be more stories about Babs and Aggie. I am currently working on a book two, which is a little darker, but features much of the same joy of life that the book one brings. And I have ideas for a number of short stories. I've got 1,000 years of history to play with these two.
Which is quite a lot.
It is, yes. And it gives a lot of fun reimaginings of certain things. I've got little ideas for, you know, the origin of the Loch Ness Monster, for example, or Samuel Pepys's hidden diary, where during the Great Fire of London. There's so much you can play with, and that's one of the joys about writing long-lived characters.
Mm.
You have the fun of seeing them throughout the centuries.
Yeah.
And, of course, there's the character of House who comes into it. House wasn't even meant to be a character to begin with, but Baba Yaga is synonymous with having a house on chicken legs. And so obviously I brought that in. And as I wrote House, he became this cross between a garden shed and a Labrador puppy. And it was just...
Obviously.
Of course, why wouldn't you have that? And he was a joy to write because he had no face, no voice, and yet I managed to... It was such a lovely challenge to express emotion. And he's actually been the character that everybody loves, that everybody talks about. His old House was just so lovely.
Oh, amazing. Well, if people want to get a copy of the book, it's called Babs and Aggie, The Good, the Bad and the Vegan. And it's available on our website, tre.radio. And it's by Hazel Hitchens, who we've been chatting with today. Hazel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by audible.co.uk. Download one title each month, plus unlimited listening to thousands of Audible originals, podcasts and audiobooks. Just click on the Audible banner at www.tre.radio.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.